Good mornings, I'm Chris Oakes, and coming up today, perhaps ironically, this is Ohio's Spring Severe Weather Awareness Week, and the devastation from last week's tornadoes is a dramatic and timely representation of the reason it's so critically important. Also this morning, the Affordable Care Act was supposed to fix the healthcare problem in this country, but the pain of medical debt is as acute as ever, and only likely to get worse as premiums, deductibles, and copayment thresholds continue to climb. So is there really any fix? And NASA's Glenn Research Center in Cleveland will be in the path of totality exactly 3 weeks from today. How the science of solar eclipses provides vital information for the future exploration of the universe. This is the Good Mornings Podcast Edition for Monday, March 18th, 2024. So even though Ohio State did not make the big dance in the field of 68, they in the NCAA men's basketball tournament, they did make headlines over the weekend, removing the interim tag from Jake Diebler's title as men's basketball head coach, signed him to a 5-year contract, from what I read, 5-year deal, right? So that's pretty impressive, and I think highly deserved. I mean, there is no question that he earned the opportunity to lead the program based on what he did over the final few weeks of the season, pulling the Buckeyes out of that dumpster fire that the season had become and taking them to the cusp of the NCAA tournament. They were not going to make the field unless they had a super strong showing in the conference tournament. I don't know that they would have necessarily had to win, but they had to, I think the consensus was they had to make it to Saturday. They had to win a couple of games, make it to the weekend of the Big Ten tournament, and they fell just short against Illinois on Friday. But then the other conference tournaments had so many upsets that a lot of bubble teams that would have otherwise made the field didn't get in because underdogs got the automatic bids in a number of the other conference tournaments, most notably Oregon, out in the Pac-12. But anyway, so it would have been a long shot for the Buckeyes to make it anyway. But I think Jake Diebler did more than enough to prove that he should be a head coach at the highest level. If Ohio State didn't hire him, somebody would have. Somebody would have taken a chance on Jake Diebler. So I'm glad that the Buckeyes locked him up for 5 years. That being said, however, and I posted this on social media over the weekend, and I've been talking with some friends of mine about this for quite some time. We were talking about, does Jake Diebler deserve the job? And I think he does, but I also wonder if there were things that went on behind the scenes with some of the other candidates that were tied for the tied to the job that they ultimately said thanks but no thanks. You know, like Dusty May or Lamont Paris or, you know, any of these other candidates that had been rumored to be connected to the Buckeyes head coaching job. I wonder how deep those conversations really got and whether those other candidates pulled themselves out of consideration for one reason or another. Maybe there's a perception that Ohio State is not fully committed to its basketball program. It is a football first school, no question. But I wonder if they were concerned that the facilities were not as up to par as some of the other top programs, or in this day and age of NIL, that the pool of money was too skewed to the football program and there wasn't enough left over for basketball. If maybe that had something, I don't know. I'm just kind of putting that out there, but I would be curious to know just how deep the conversations got with some of these other candidates. And if the Buckeyes turned to Jake Diebler saying, hey, nobody else seems to want the job, or you know what I mean. But that's not to take away from Jake Diebler's qualifications. And I think it was the right move. And I hope that he has tremendous success with the Buckeyes basketball program. But I would be curious to know why some of those other candidates didn't end up getting the job, whether it was their decision or whether it was Ohio State's decision, or, you know, what went on behind the scenes. Would be rather interested to know that. But anyway, that's just speculation at this point. Congratulations to Jake Diebler. By the way, have you filled out your bracket yet? You filled out your March Madness bracket? I saw this on the Newswire. The Mega Millions jackpot is getting close to $1 billion. Lottery officials say no ticket matched all six numbers drawn Friday night, so the grand prize is now an estimated $875 million for tomorrow night's drawing. You know that the odds of winning, I bring that up because the odds of winning the Mega Millions are 1 in 302.6 million. You have a 1 in 302.6 million chance of winning the Mega Millions, and that still is exponentially better odds of winning the Mega Millions than you have of filling out a 100% perfect NCAA men's basketball tournament bracket. At best, your odds of filling out a perfect bracket are 1 in 120.2 billion. 1 in 120.2 billion odds of filling out a perfect bracket as compared to the Mega Millions odds of 1 in 302.6 million. So you look at it that way, you're better off buying Mega Millions tickets than you are filling out your bracket. But we're going to fill out the brackets, right? That's what we're going to do. By the way, also no winner in the Powerball drawing. So that means the jackpot will be worth an estimated $645 million in tonight's drawing for the Powerball. So a lot of money on the line in those games of chance. So on this Monday morning, I thought this was kind of interesting. Last week, Senator Bernie Sanders made headlines by unveiling a bill to establish a standard 4-day work week in the United States. Obviously, this is not going anywhere. There is absolutely no chance that this will ever become law. But Bernie Sanders is doing what Bernie Sanders does. And he says, and there's an argument here, he says that American workers are over 400% more productive today than they were in the 1940s. And so if you trim the work week to 32 hours from 40 hours, you'll still get plenty of productivity out of the workforce. And supporters point to that experiment in the UK where a bunch of companies agreed for 6 months to participate in a study of the impact of a 4-day work week. That's what they did. For 6 months, they trimmed, these companies that were participating, trimmed their regular work week to 32 hours from 40 hours. And they all actually agreed to extend. It worked out so well, they agreed to extend the experiment for a full year. And 90% of the companies have made it permanent or have made it long term, have no plans to go back to a 5-day work week anytime soon. Some of them have already come out and said, we're going to make this permanent. And what they found was that employees were happier. Employees said it helped their physical and mental health. No big surprise that employees were happier because they only had to work 32 hours instead of 40 hours for the same amount of pay, by the way. But they also noted that there was lower employee turnover and even more efficiency among the employees. And I'm thinking to myself, yes, but there's less turnover because most other companies are still 40-hour work weeks. So if everybody had a 32-hour work week, would you still see lower turnover in your job if changing jobs meant that if the 32-hour work week was not a perk, would you still have lower turnover and would you still have more efficiency? I mean, it can be argued that the people in the companies that were doing 32-hour week or a 4-day work week instead of a 5-day work week, that the employees were working harder because they didn't want to mess up a good thing. You know what I mean? If our productivity suffers, then we'll have to go back to 5 days. So we're going to work harder during those 4 days so that we can keep that perk. And again, if everybody, if it was mandated a four-day work week, would that still be the case? Anyway, I think there's more there to that than what the proponents are considering. So it's not going anywhere anyway, but I just thought it was kind of interesting. A couple of other interesting items here among the first things you need to know this morning, the most interesting and buzzworthy stories of the day. You remember a couple of years ago when somebody stumbled upon this 10-foot tall metal monolith in Utah out in the middle of nowhere, and they were there was speculation that it might have been extraterrestrial visitors that that came to Earth and placed it there. Well, there's another monolith that was discovered last week in Wales in the United Kingdom. It says the size and shape are similar to the one found in Utah back in 2020. Craig Muir was hiking when he came across the structure. He said he thought it was a UFO at first. It has three polished sides and no rivets. And there are similar monoliths that have popped up around the world since the one in Red Rock County, Utah, was discovered a couple of 3 years ago, 4 years ago almost now. Those structures have been spotted in Phoenix, New Mexico, the Netherlands, England, and Colombia. So just more signs. We are not alone in the universe. On the day of the eclipse, is that going to be the date that the aliens finally invade? Are these all warning signs? That's what I want to know. Every day we've got to have something to worry about. And that's today's story. The aliens are coming. There's more signs. The aliens are coming. And it's going to be eclipse day. That's what it's going to be. You're going to get invaded. Just prepare yourself now, I'm saying. Prepare yourself now. And some sad news to report this morning. Have to pass along. The man who invented the modern karaoke machine has passed away. Shigeichi Negishi, I think his hybrid is Shigeichi Negishi, has passed away at the age of 100. The Japanese businessman invented the first version of the karaoke machine back in 1967 after a coworker jokingly made fun of his singing voice. His family says he passed away in January after a fall at the age of 100. We are just now learning that the inventor of the karaoke machine has died. So there you go. Some of the most interesting and buzzworthy stories to get your Monday morning started.
WFIN News, I'm Matt Demchek. Your WTOL 11 weather, partly to mostly cloudy today, a chance of snow, a high in the upper 30s. Partly cloudy tonight, a low around 30. Ohio Governor Mike DeWine issued a proclamation declaring a state of emergency across 11 counties, including Hancock County, that were impacted by last week's severe weather. The governor visited the Indian Lake area in Logan County, where a strong tornado caused fatalities and injured many more people on Thursday night.
The governor says his heart goes out to those who have been injured and those who have died. He also says the state will do everything it can to help those who lost homes and businesses. And he's so impressed by the spirit of the people.
To see their spirit and their resilience and their toughness, how strong they are, it's just absolutely amazing to me.
State leaders say right now the focus is on damage assessments to figure out financial assistance. At Indian Lake High School, Doug Petcast.
The Findlay Police Department Officer of the Year and Civilian of the Year ceremony was held at City Hall. Recognized were Police Officer Detective Christopher Brickner and Civilian Stephanie Witted. Detective Brickner was honored with the award for showing his dedication to his career and putting his professionalism on display on many occasions. On one such occasion, Brickner located a vehicle suspected of assisting two escaped inmates from Wood County and was able to recover evidence and obtain confessions from the occupants as to their involvement in the escape. And Stephanie Witted received the award for taking great pride in her work and always being up for any challenge. See a picture of both with the police chief in the story on our website. Ohio Treasurer Robert Sprague of Findlay has announced a $15 million purchase of a two-year fixed-rate Israel bond. He says the purchase carries on Ohio's long-standing tradition of investing in Israel bonds. Treasurer Sprague went on to say, with their strong competitive interest rates and solid repayment history, the bonds continue to provide a valuable investment for Ohio. Get more in the story on our website. Finley City Schools is reminding students and parents that there's no school for students today. Today is a professional development day for staff members. And remember, there will be no school coming up on Monday, April 8th for the solar eclipse. You can see the full school district calendar in the story on our website. Remember, you can always get more news online anytime at WFIN.com.
Well, now we get to our cover story this morning, and it just so happens that this is Ohio's Spring Severe Weather Awareness Week. It's almost a bit ironic, but if you ever needed any further proof of just how critically important this is, you need look no further than the devastation from last week's tornadoes across northwest and west central Ohio. And joining us this morning is the director of the North Central Ohio chapter of the American Red Cross, Todd James. Todd, thanks very much for taking some time this morning to talk about this. Again, so many people in this part of the state have been touched by this just recently. It just emphasizes how important this is.
Thank you, Chris. It's good to be back with you again this morning. I wish we were under a little better circumstances.
Sure.
Definitely. You know, we always like to talk with you about being ready before something happens. And unfortunately, something did happen, and our neighbors to the south have really gone through the ringer the last few days. And,
you know,
are going to be picking up the pieces for a while.
What was interesting in watching and listening to all of the coverage of everything that happened at Indian Lake last week, and I've mentioned on Friday's program that I have very deep ties to that area. It's where I went to school. Mm-hmm. Still a number of family and very dear friends who live in the area, and found out over the weekend that one of my classmates lost her aunt, who was among those who perished in the tornadoes. But everybody that they talked to that lived through it said that they've never seen anything like it before. And you have been deployed to a number of these scenarios, these situations in the past. And I know you are not involved in the recovery at Indian Lake, so I want to be clear about that. But based on your experience, what is happening there now? Now that they've had a few days to sort of assess the damage, get together a game plan, and heading into this new week, what's going on there right now in terms of the recovery?
Well, right now, you know, from the Red Cross point of view, I mean, our main focus, I am sure, down there is still number one, making sure the folks that lost their homes, can't get back into their homes, need a place to stay, have a safe place to stay, that everybody has access to meals. We're, of course, working with our partners in the area, making sure folks have access to health care, to disaster crisis counseling. Over the weekend, our teams, the teams from the Emergency Management Agency, will have been out assessing the damage. Mm-hmm. In terms of recovery from a financial standpoint and aid that might be available, it all starts with, we have to know what the level of damage is. So that's a big part of the early recovery effort, is just kind of assessing the damage, which that's what the teams will be out there doing. And also, a lot of homeowners will at this point be able to start getting back to their homes, to their properties, to see what's there, to start cleaning up. We'll have teams on the ground, as will many other agencies. I mean, you've seen Facebook, and the outpouring of support for the Indian Lake region has just been phenomenal.
It's almost,
we see it at every disaster, but every time I see it, it still is like, you know, this is what it's all about.
Yeah, it's almost overwhelming, and it's been interesting now that they've gotten past the initial shock. They can sort of coordinate all this a little bit better and start to really come up with a focused plan for what happens next. But it is going to be a very long recovery process, as you mentioned. When you get deployed to an area that's been impacted like this, what do you hear? I'm sure that there are things that you hear time and time again that people say that they wish they had known or wish that they would have done ahead of the storm. What would be at the top of the list in terms of preparation?
Well, I think number one, once folks, you know, start to get over the shock of it and the trauma, I mean, that's a huge part of a disaster like this, especially for children, is the lingering and long lasting trauma that can come from this. And, mm-hmm. and one of the things that we try to help address. I think the thing that, you know, it sticks with me, and I heard it on the very first disaster I ever deployed to, which was a tornado, the Joplin tornado. And I've heard it many times since then. And I encourage everyone. This is why you pay attention to the warnings. Unfortunately, you know, the National Weather Service does a great job and the best job possible with today's technology to give us as much early warning as they can. Sometimes we get the warnings and nothing happens. And unfortunately, when that happens, folks don't necessarily pay as much attention to the next time.
Right.
And that next time could be the time when you got the warning and you needed to heed it. And I think that's probably one of the most common things I've heard through the years, and not just tornadoes, but, you know, just that, wow, I wish I would have paid attention this
yeah.
time, because this time it happened. So when those warnings go off, when it's a tornado watch, when it's a tornado warning, you need to take it seriously, especially if it's a warning. Number one is to know the difference and make sure that your family, especially children, know the difference between a tornado watch, which is, hey, the Weather Service is telling us the conditions are right out there. If the right things come together, we could be in for some serious trouble. You need to be ready to act quickly.
Mm-hmm.
And when we hear that tornado warning, you know, that means, hey, we've either seen one or our radar is telling us that you need to take cover now. You
right.
need to take action to protect yourself and your family now. And,
right.
and when you hear those, take that action. I mean, worst case scenario, you went to the basement and hung out for 20 minutes and nothing happened.
But
I mean, best case scenario. That's the best yeah. case scenario. The worst case scenario, unfortunately, is what we've seen that's happened in Indian
exactly.
Lake and many other areas across the country that were hit during this storm.
Yeah. One of the other things, and we've talked in the past, and folks can find you know, checklists and advice online about preparing a kit for a disaster. And I hear some people sometimes say, well, why do I need to worry about having food or having all of these things on hand if my home gets destroyed by a tornado? It's going to be gone anyway. But you are actually far more likely to have a home that is damaged but not destroyed, that you may be you may not have access to power
yeah.
and, you know, all of that for a while. So, I mean, that's the important reason why you need to prepare for what happens afterwards.
Exactly. I mean, and it's not just the food and the water. Those, of course, are vital and the basic things we tell everybody. But you're also, you know, packing things like medication, important papers,
mm-hmm.
flashlight, those things that you're going to want to have if you do lose your home that are going to be vital for you to have after to start the recovery. And it's sometimes it's a case of you may be stuck in your home for a while and
right.
not be able to get anywhere. If it's flooding this time of year, of course, when we have storms, we also see a lot
right.
of flooding, could be a power outage. So the idea of preparing the family emergency kit is for multiple scenarios, whether you have to evacuate your home and you want to have that important information and those basic things with you, or whether you get stuck in your home and can't get out for a few days
yeah.
and you need to have those basic things with you.
And a lot of folks, I know some friends were talking about themselves or their relatives in the Indian Lake region have been stuck in their homes, not being able to get out for a while. So again, making sure that you have those provisions is very important. And this may be a bit self-serving, but I want to bring this up. You know, we think in the digital age that the internet and our cell phones are going to be the way we get information. But in a storm, internet may not be available. Cell service may
mm-hmm.
be very spotty. Your radio is always going to be there and may be the lifeline for immediate important information.
I couldn't agree with you more, Chris. When we teach our Be Red Cross Ready classes and we show people how to put together their family emergency kit, one of the first things we say you need to have a good radio. We recommend that it have the weather band available along mm-hmm. with AM, FM, have the weather band, multiple sources of power. So, you know, you get a radio that doesn't just rely on batteries, but maybe it has a hand crank or a solar panel also. Because information is vital before, during, and after a disaster. And you're right, when tornadoes come through, you know, they start tearing down cell towers along with everything else.
Right.
Everybody, of course, is going onto their phones and their devices because they're trying to get information. So it becomes overloaded in the system. You should have seen me around here the other day when all the sirens were going off and I'm getting my family ready. And,
yeah.
You know, I've got a phone in one hand. I got radios on and multiple, you know, information is key. And
right.
So a radio, having a good working radio is vital for that information.
It may sound a bit old fashioned, but it is still a lifeline in those types of emergencies. So, like I said, it may seem
No, it's not self-serving, Chris. You're doing a great service for everybody because radio is still the number one source people
right.
turn to for information
yep.
during a disaster
yep.
like this. So it's vital to have it.
Again, Todd James is head of the North Central Ohio chapter of the American Red Cross with some timely reminders for Ohio's Spring Severe Weather Awareness Week. Todd, thanks very much for taking some time. We appreciate it.
Hey, Chris, thank you. Thank you for getting the word out to everybody. And I heard the story, you know, we're getting a lot of calls, people wanting to know how best they can help the folks down in Logan County. And, you know, it's amazing the outpouring of help, but we do have to do it right. So
yeah.
that's working with groups like the United Way down there who are coordinating the efforts. That's really the
Absolutely.
Best way to do it. Visit their website, see what they need and how you can help them.
Todd, thanks very much for the update. We appreciate it.
Thank you, Chris. Have a great day.
Well, you know, since the Affordable Care Act was implemented a decade ago, some 40 million Americans have gained insurance coverage, and the national uninsured rate has hit an all-time new low each successive year. But the pain of medical debt still is not fixed. In fact, between 25 and 40% of people who have insurance still have or have had debts that they have struggled to pay off. In half of those cases, it was over $2,500, and it is still the leading cause of bankruptcy in the United States. Mike Waterbury is CEO of GoodRoot, a company that says they are reinventing healthcare, and we'll get into that in a minute here. But first, Mike, you are a veteran of this industry. How did we get here? How did we let medical debt become the number one cause of bankruptcy in the United States?
That's a great question, Chris. I mean, I think ultimately, as costs go up and the complexity of this, of our benefits and our bills and the lack of transparency, I think what's happened over time is the burden of this cost has been placed on the patient. I think the parties involved with sort of providing and administering health benefits in the United States have potentially put profit ahead of the patient and driving this cause of bankruptcy for individuals who, you know, when you talk about medical debt, it's like not like credit card debt, right? We're not choosing to buy things. We either have an illness that we're dealing with or
right.
an accident that we're dealing with. And, you know, it's everyone's responsibility to raise awareness and talk about things that people can do, whether it's employers or patients, to assist and prevent medical debt.
And this is likely to get even worse as the cost of premiums and deductibles and copays and all of that continue to go up, forcing even more people into hard choices and leaving families with even bigger bills to pay.
That's correct. I mean, in our study, we found that 92% of people actually have avoided care because of the fear of medical debt, which is even like sort of an underlying issue that's definitely caused bigger healthcare issues. And I think, you know, as you get your coverage gets, you know, more burden on you through deductibles and coinsurance, it's just key for employees to be engaged and understand their benefits and do their best to understand the cost of care and make good decisions about their care. I mean, sometimes it's very complicated, but I think it's ultimately, you know, everybody's responsibility to become more engaged and understand what coverage you have and what are the best decisions for your care.
We mentioned employers, and still the vast majority of those who are insured get their coverage through their employer. Why should employers care about the medical debt of their employees? I mean, I can hear a lot of folks saying, hey, we're footing a good chunk of the bill for the medical insurance to begin with. Beyond that, what responsibility should we have?
That's a good question, because the costs are going up to employers as well. I mean, we have over 100 employees here at Goodroot, and I deal with it every day myself. I mean, I think you're making a large investment in your employees, and you really should look at that investment as wanting to drive the sort of financial and health and the well-being of those employees so that they can be satisfied with their job and productive. And there's things that employers can do to help employees get more out of their benefits. I mean, there's care navigation companies that help people understand their benefits, help them make good decisions about where to get their care, what drug to be on. And if they get a bill, help them negotiate that bill and potentially apply for financial assistance. I think, Chris, one of the things that definitely want to get awareness out there around is financial assistance at nonprofit hospitals. People don't realize, our study showed that over half the people didn't even know that they existed. And so it's important to be able to support your employees. And when it comes to financial assistance, nonprofit hospitals are required by law to provide financial assistance to individuals that don't have insurance. And that concludes when you're in your deductible, where a family of four making up to like $120,000 qualifies in most cases for free care. And people just don't know about it. So helping them understand these programs and navigate the healthcare system is key to get the most out of that investment.
Why is it that more people don't know that assistance is available for things like hospital care?
That's a great question. I think first and foremost, I think sometimes people, when they hear about charity care and words like federal poverty level, make the assumption that it doesn't apply to them, because those words don't necessarily are something that you're a hardworking American, you don't necessarily think about those. But I think that's first and foremost. And then I think our hospitals, our nonprofit hospitals, albeit do great work and provide great care, have not done a great job of promoting and making these programs accessible and making people aware of them. I mean, a lot of times they're buried on hospital websites. They're links that then lead you to a paper application. You have to provide copies of bank statements and W-2s. And so one of our companies, Breathe Health, has created a technology solution, a digital solution that makes it very easy, a lot of questions and decision tree that leads you right into a process to see if you qualify. And then you can upload documents and easily finalize the application for whatever hospital you're looking at and submit it. So we think solutions like that are key to making it easier and getting the people that are eligible to apply and hopefully qualify for the assistance that they deserve.
So that's kind of where your company comes in. As we mentioned, we want to talk a little bit about this and, you know, your grand design of reinventing healthcare. Because you, as you mentioned, more people likely qualify for this than realize it. And so it's a matter of demystifying it, getting it out there. You mentioned the health cost navigator program. Talk about how all of this can work in conjunction with a healthcare plan for employers, employees, and so on.
I mean, you highlighted a lot of areas. I mean, at Goodroot, we're focused on creating companies that address a lot of these challenges. We don't feel like there's a big bang approach to fixing healthcare, so we try to address it one system at a time. We also looking at medical debt and understanding the drivers of medical debt and providing that information to everyone so that we can all be accountable for what role we're playing is key. But yeah, we have companies that one of our companies, Emory, is a benefit navigation company that specializes in helping people negotiate bills and apply for financial assistance. We felt like that was a missing sort of a gap in the industry. So we create a company to do that. We provide a lot of pharmacy related solutions as well to make prescription drugs more affordable. So we're focused on every piece that we can address and improve the inefficiency. So, we're ultimately trying to make this system work better for the patient.
And ultimately, what will be the fix? I mean, how can we fix this problem in the richest country on earth and the country with the best healthcare system on earth? I know we don't have a whole lot of time, but what's the key to fixing it?
I mean, I think ultimately the way I look at it is if we understand medical debt and we understand the root causes, we study it, we provide that information, and then we hold the industry accountable, whether it's an insurance company, a pharmacy benefit management company, a hospital, everybody, even physicians, right? Everybody has a role to play. I think the key is to get awareness out. We look at medical debt as a way to like go to the failure point and work your way back. So we're doing a lot of work with states, with charities, with employers to really help with medical debt, but then ultimately understand it, provide insight to what's causing it, and then support and drive fixes to those issues. I think that to me is the key that will start to not only reduce medical debt, but prevent it as well.
One thing is for sure, Americans are great at coming up with creative solutions to problems, but first we have to recognize what the problem is and how pervasive it is. Again, Mike Waterbury is CEO of GoodRoot. Mike, thanks very much for taking the time. We appreciate it.
Thank you, Chris.
This is Good Mornings with Chris Oakes on 1330 WFIN, WFIN.com, and 95.5 FM.
We interrupt this program to bring you a broken news alert.
A Montana man is pleading guilty to two felony wildlife crimes over a years-long effort to create giant sheep hybrids. Hybrids. 80-year-old Jack Schubarth owns what he describes as an alternative livestock ranch. This just keeps getting better and better. An alternative livestock ranch is what he has. It stretches 215 acres, according to a press release from the Department of Justice. The DOJ says Mr. Schubarth tried to create the species of giant sheep hybrids by importing parts of the largest sheep species in the world to create cloned embryos to implant in a female sheep on his ranch. And you can't just do that, apparently. That is a no-no. His goal, he said, was to sell the species to hunting facilities. I'm not sure if there is a great market for sheep hunting, but I suppose if you create a giant sheep, that there would be a market for that. Apparently, Mr. Schubarth conspired with at least five other individuals beginning all the way back in 2013 to sell genetically engineer the giant sheep and then sell them for high prices to shooting preserves. So, giant sheep hybrids. How giant are we talking here is what I wonder. How big are we talking? We're talking sheep the size of yaks? What is... I'm not sure. But anyway, he is now pleaded guilty. I'm not sure if there's prison time involved. It'd just be a fine if he's got to agree to no longer create giant sheep hybrids. I don't know what this involves, but... There you go. Elsewhere in the broken news this morning, the City Museum of St. Louis, Missouri has now set a new Guinness World Record for the most people wearing underwear on their heads at the same time. Well, now that's a record that you can be proud to hold. Most people wearing underwear on their heads at the same time. The museum, it says, beat the previous record of 270, gathering this past Thursday 355 underwear hat-wearing people, according to news reports. And this is not the only Guinness World Record title held by the museum. It previously set the record for largest pencil, the longest seesaw, and the largest tennis racket. But this, I think, takes the cake. The most people wearing underwear on their heads at the same time. You can probably expect that right there when you enter the city of St. Louis on their giant sign Welcome to St. Louis, Missouri, home of the world record for the most people wearing underwear on their heads at the same time. By the way, the museum also holds the unofficial record for the world's largest pair of underpants, which you can view for yourself at the City Museum of St. Louis. Plan your summer vacation now. You know, have you ever been to a Bucky's store? They have them primarily in the South and a few out West. Bucky's, it's like this giant convenience store, and, you know, people in gas station convenience store chain, and people just rave about Bucky's. My wife and I went to our first Bucky's when we were in Daytona a few weeks ago, back in January, and it's just a big store, basically, but everybody goes wild about Bucky's. Unfortunately, one man has been permanently banned from Bucky's in Tennessee after he brought his pet duck into the store. Justin Wood and his emotional support duck, Wrinkle, were greeted warmly by fellow shoppers who wanted to pet Wrinkle and find out more about him, according to a video posted on Mr. Wood's YouTube channel. However, store employees did not share the excitement of customers, explaining that service animals have to be restrained. They have to be on a leash, and he wasn't. Apparently, Wrinkle the duck was being wheeled around in a stroller, and he was not on a leash, and so they asked him to leave. But he didn't. Mr. Wood continued his visit to the store, putting Wrinkle on an imaginary leash. Unfortunately, Mr. Wood could not duck the long arm of the law, it says here, ba-dum-bum, who informed Mr. Wood when he left the location, he was greeted by police. Police were waiting, and they informed him that he was permanently banned, not just from that store in Tennessee, but every other Bucky's location nationwide. Apparently, Mr. Wood in the video said, Bucky's doesn't love Wrinkle the duck. He said, that's okay. She did nothing but make everybody happy in there. So, Wrinkle the duck, now banned from Bucky's. Wow. couple of other items here from the broken news, the odd and unusual side of the headlines. Let's see here. Joseph and Susanna Landa bought a $2 million home in Queens, New York. And this, I guess, several months ago, they bought this this home, but they haven't been able to move in because a squatter is still living there. There's a guy living in the home and refuses to leave. The Landas bought the home, oh, it says here, 5 months ago, and Brett Flores has not vacated. Mr. Flores claims he has permission from the previous owner, who has since passed on, to stay in the house. The home previously belonged to one Bernard Fernandez, and Mr. Flores took care of the elderly man until he passed on. And this is the crazy part. According to New York City law, Mr. Flores is considered a tenant, and even though possession of the home has changed, because he is a tenant, he has to be procedurally evicted from the home. And that involves a long and drawn out court process. The next hearing is scheduled for April. So a month from now, it's been 5 months. It could be 6 months to a year before they're able to move into their new $2 million home. It's crazy. Crazy. I mean, I know the housing market is insane in New York, but that is just, wow. And finally this morning, from the international file of the broken news, our dumb criminal of the day. Today comes from the UK, where a thief is now facing 2 years in jail because the hole he made to abscond with his ill-gotten treasure was not big enough. Allow me to explain. It involves a theft from back in October of last year at the Royal Lancers and Nottinghamshire Yeomanry Museum. Okay. Anyway, so he wants to rob the museum of some of its treasures. Graham Gallen is accused of cutting a hole into the floor of the museum and making off with several priceless antiques. Now, police say that Mr. Gallen never actually entered the museum. Instead, he cut a hole into the floor and grabbed objects using a tool and a remote-controlled camera to see what he was grabbing. However, he was undone because he had to leave behind a chalice that was too big to fit into the hole that he had cut in the floor. And when police tested the artifact that was left behind, they discovered his DNA. So again, he was using a tool to remove the items. I would guess that he got the chalice partway through the hole and then started yanking on it. You know, so he's got his fingerprints and his DNA on it because he's trying to yank it through the hole. It wouldn't fit, so he had to leave that behind. But he also, in the process, left behind his DNA. police were able to identify their man, and he is now facing 2 years in jail. Unfortunately, some of the stolen objects have yet to be recovered. Police are still investigating the possibility that there were accomplices in this effort. So, stay tuned. There you go. That is today's Broken News Report. An update on the odd and unusual side of the headlines. We now return you to your regularly scheduled programming.
When local news breaks, you can hear about it on social media at lightning speed. And while getting you the information fast is important, WFIN will always present the story only after verifying with actual sourced facts. This is WFIN News Director Matt Demchek. Trust the voice that's been covering the news in Findlay and Hancock County for more than 80 years. You can depend on us to get the story right every time. On social media, 1330 WFIN, WFIN.com, and at 95.5 FM.
And now your daily download, the numbers behind the news and the statistics that shape our lives. I think we would all agree that this is good news. Marriage rates in the U.S. are back to pre-pandemic levels. According to an analysis of new government data by the Bowling Green State University National Center for Family and Marriage Research, there were just over 2 million marriages in the U.S. in 2022. That's the latest year for which final data is available, from 2022. So just over 2 million marriages. That works out to roughly 6.2 marriages per 1,000 people, or a little over 31 marriages per 1,000 women in this country. And that is the highest level since 2018. Marriage rates dropped when COVID hit. In 2020, there were only 1.6 million marriages worldwide, and the number of marriages hit a 50-year low in 2021 with 28 marriages per 1,000 women. However, we have rebounded. While numbers seem to have recovered from the pandemic, the last two decades have seen an overall downward trend in marriage rates, but at least we are back to where we were before all of this COVID stuff. Utah remains the number one. It's probably not surprising when you think Utah, big Mormon population, very much marriage is the center of Mormon life. Utah, number one in marriages in the country. New Mexico is actually the state with the fewest marriages when you look state by state. And interestingly, Ohio ranks number 42. We are lagging behind in the number of marriages in the state of Ohio, just 27.9 marriages per 1,000 women in the state of Ohio. And as a matter of fact, Ohio and I believe Illinois is the other outlier in terms of regions. In the Midwest, Ohio and Illinois are at the bottom of the list. So we've got some work to do, Ohio. I'm going to get these kids married off. Well, you know, I was just thinking the other day about the total solar eclipse being now just 3 weeks away, and something dawned on me. I hadn't really thought about this before. As it is passing over us here in Northwest Ohio, it will go on to move through the Cleveland area, where it just so happens that there is a NASA research center. Dr. Carolyn Mercer is the chief technologist for NASA's Science Mission Directorate. She lives in the Cleveland area and worked for the Glenn Research Center for many, many years. I understand your job now is based out of NASA headquarters, but you've worked very closely with the folks at the Glenn Research Center for a long time, and I'm sure still have very close contact with a number of them. How fortuitous of a coincidence for the eclipse to literally be passing right overhead.
So it is an amazingly great thing that it is passing right over our own backyards. You know, there was a total solar eclipse in 2017 that my family, we drove down to Kentucky to go see. But nobody around here has to drive anywhere. All we have to do is walk out in our backyards, and it's going to be right there.
So I wonder, will this be a work event for the scientists at the Glenn Research Center, or will those folks be looking to experience it kind of like the rest of us?
So a lot of the people at the Glenn Research Center are going to be down at the Great Lakes Science Center for the NASA Village for the total solar eclipse. And so they'll be down there talking with the public. I'll be down there, too, over the weekend. But a lot of folks, you know, they have to do their testing and their evaluations. And so they'll be at work just like a regular day. But I guarantee they will be stepping outside in the afternoon so that they can witness that event just like all the rest of us.
Yeah, absolutely. The reason I ask, because I know you referenced the eclipse in 2017, and I noticed looking at NASA's website that during that eclipse, the agency funded nearly a dozen studies to collect data that it says is only available during eclipses. I was almost a bit surprised by that in this day and age, with all of the technology that we have, that still one of the best ways to gather information for the world's leading scientists is to basically go out and look at the sun when it disappears behind the moon.
Yeah, so it may sound surprising, but it's absolutely true. So, you know, for all of us who are lucky enough to be in the path of totality, that's what we call it, where the moon exactly covers the sun, right, so that we get, you know, a twilight experience. We only get to see that for about 3 or 4 minutes, which is a really long time, and it's going to be awesome. But that's only 3 or 4 minutes at any given time, you know, right, in a given place. But this eclipse is going to pass through the entirety of North America. It's going to start in Mexico and end up all the way in Canada. And that's going to take over 3 hours. So NASA is asking for citizen scientists, if they can, to take a photograph of what they see during the eclipse. And collectively, we'll gather all of those photographs, put them together, and we'll get like a 3-hour movie of what the sun was doing during the eclipse. And during the eclipse, right, the Earth and the moon and the sun are perfectly aligned.
Right.
So that all we see is the very outer reaches of the sun's atmosphere.
Mm-hmm.
And we call that the corona. And that's what people will be taking a picture of. And so having a 3-hour movie of the corona from all across the Northern Hemisphere is data that we actually can't get from a single spacecraft.
And I noticed that one of the research studies from 2017 involved learning how the sun affects space weather. Explain what that is, and how does understanding space weather, why is this important?
So, you know, people think that deep space is completely empty.
Mm-hmm.
But it turns out it's not. There are millions, a steady stream of high energy particles and magnetic fields and the light and the heat that comes from the sun. And we call that the solar wind. And that solar wind impacts everything. It impacts the Earth. It interacts with our magnetic field and causes the aurora. It interacts with our upper atmosphere, and it affects our weather and our climate. So if we can, that solar wind is created in that corona, the light that we see during this total solar eclipse.
I see.
So if we can understand what's going on in the corona, we can understand what that solar wind is doing.
And the only time to really see the corona is during an eclipse.
Exactly, which is why that movie is really important.
Yeah.
And it matters a lot, too, because there's radiation in that solar wind, and that can affect electronics here on Earth and on our spacecraft. But it can also affect the human health of our astronauts on the space station on the astronauts that are soon going to go to the moon.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, I was going to ask, you know, is this how important is this for our hopes for exploration of outer space with the moon and perhaps eventually moving on to Mars or other parts of the universe?
Yeah, it's really important. So we want to be able to predict really severe solar storms so that we can protect our astronauts and protect our electronics, too. You know, get a nice predictive capability so that we can stay out of harm's way.
Yeah. And again, this, I know because we've talked about it in the past, that observing eclipses, I mean, from the very beginning of science, since the earliest days of science, when mankind was just discovering that there was more out there than just what he could see with the naked eye, observing eclipses has been a big part of learning about space. What are some of the things over time that people have learned in the past by viewing eclipses?
Yeah, up until very recently, really the only thing we knew about the corona came by people watching during eclipses. Mm-hmm. And so a really interesting thing that we learned, like 150 years ago, people were studying the spectrum of the light from that corona during the eclipse, just like you can take light through a prism and you can break it up into red, blue, and green.
Right.
Well, they noticed that there was a really, really strong amount of green light. And they couldn't figure out what that was because none of the elements that we knew about would fluoresce at that light, that wavelength. And it took us decades to figure out that what that was a very particular form of iron that only exists at really high temperatures. And so what we have come to learn is that that corona that we see is over a million times hotter than the atmosphere of the sun below it, which is really strange, right? Yeah. And we learned that doing an observation of an eclipse.
That is amazing stuff. And of course, I've mentioned this on the program before as well, it's just, it boggles my mind. And I know that it's just a matter of mathematics and formulas and so on, but to know exactly when an eclipse is going to happen and where, and the fact that we can look back the last time 200 years ago that there was an eclipse in Northwest Ohio, and we know exactly the date and time that that happened. We know the exact date and time that the next one is going to happen. That to me is just boggles the mind.
Yeah, so it's really great, but I got to say, of all of the problems that we work on, that's actually one of the easier ones.
That's the easiest one, yeah.
When these things are going to happen.
But see, for us lay people, this is even amazing stuff. So to think about all of the science that goes on even beyond that, and I would imagine to that end that something like the eclipse is a terrific, I guess, for lack of a better term, PR event for NASA and for scientists in general, in terms of getting people interested, especially getting young people interested in learning more about science and about the universe and so on.
Oh, absolutely. In fact, a lot of NASA scientists got their start when they were kids. They saw a really interesting physical phenomenon and just got hooked on science.
Yeah.
So yeah, at NASA Glenn, there's going to be a big outreach, like I said, at the Great Lakes Science Center, but that's just the weekend of the eclipse. They continuously have programs in education and outreach. We have lots of programs for students, all the way from, you know, K through 12 up to college students, a lot of internships. So we love talking with kids and getting them as excited about science and space exploration as we are.
So the event itself is on April 8th, but you look long term, it goes well beyond just April 8th in terms of drawing more people in, those whose interest has been piqued by all of this.
Yeah, definitely.
It is just 3 weeks away. Dr. Carolyn Mercer is the chief technologist for NASA's Science Mission Directorate, and from the Cleveland area, has worked at the Glenn Research Center there for many years. Dr. Mercer, thanks very much for taking the time. We appreciate it.
Thank you very much. It was a pleasure talking to you.
And that will finish up our podcast for today. I want to thank all of our guests for joining us on the program this morning. Remember, you can get more information about all of the topics that we talk about each and every day on the show at our webpage. And that, of course, is goodmornings.net. Coming up tomorrow morning on the program, an Election Day special recap of our series of candidate forums featuring the contested local races in the Republican primary. We'll hear from the candidates for prosecutor, sheriff, Hancock County commissioner, and of course, the 83rd district seat in the Ohio House of Representatives. So until tomorrow morning, that is Good Mornings for this morning. Now that you've had a good morning, go on out and make it a good day. We'll catch you back here tomorrow.